Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. The United States and Russia agree on a cessation of hostilities in Syria. The move could pave the way for an expansion of humanitarian aid to Syria and set a stage for a resumption of talks on a political transition. In a joint statement on Monday, the U.S. and Russia proposed that a ceasefire begin February 27th. It would apply to all parties in the conflict with the exception of terrorist groups. UN envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, has this warning.
When you have a process leading to a cessation of hostilities, those who don't want it are going to try to spoil it.
Some of the issues linked to the cessation still appear to be unresolved. British Prime Minister David Cameron says the results of a referendum on Britain's exit from the European Union will be final. Speaking to Parliament, Mr. Cameron dismissed calls for a second referendum.
Such an approach also ignores more profound points about democracy, diplomacy, and legality. This is a straight democratic decision, staying in or leaving, and no government can ignore that.
Officials from the office of the Prime Minister say if the June 23rd referendum is passed, Cameron would invoke Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, which sets in motion a two-year negotiation process for a British exit. Police in Uganda arrested opposition leader Kizza Besigye on Monday. Besigye lost an election Thursday to incumbent President Yoweri Museveni. The opposition leader charges that the election was fraudulent. Besigye had planned to go to the headquarters of the Electoral Commission. He wanted to collect evidence there ahead of a possible legal challenge to the election. This is VOA News. Bolivia's president, Evo Morales, is asking the country to wait patiently for the final result of a referendum on whether to allow him to run for a fourth term. He added that he will respect the outcome either way. Partial official results from Sunday's referendum show the no vote at about 60%. The death toll from the cyclone that struck the South Pacific island nation of Fiji Saturday has risen to 29. Aerial footage taken of Fiji in the aftermath of Cyclone Winston reveal a landscape filled with rubble. Human Rights Watch says violent government crackdowns on protesters are happening in Ethiopia's Oromia region, despite official claims that all is normal. A new report details statements from opposition members and activists saying that more than 200 people have been killed since November 12th, and thousands more have been arrested. It says security forces have fired aimlessly into crowds of protesters and have tortured detainees. Protests in the Oromia region broke out in opposition to plans to expand the municipal boundary of Addis Ababa to accommodate an increase in development. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is in Burundi for a visit aimed at calming a political crisis that has embroiled the country for almost a year. Mr. Ban arrived in Bujumbura on Monday. Ahead of the visit, four people were killed in two grenade attacks in the capital. A study to determine whether the Zika virus is causing babies to be born with microcephaly, a serious birth defect, has begun in Brazil. A 16-member team from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are doing the study. Dr. Aaron Staples is an epidemiologist with the CDC.
We'll also be taking blood samples from the mom and the baby to look for the presence of Zika virus infection, and then we'll be comparing between, again, the moms that didn't have microcephaly, moms that do have a child born with microcephaly.
The Zika outbreak has been declared an international health emergency. The legislative fight over the U.S. Supreme Court vacancy begins Monday. Michael Bowman reports.
For weeks, or possibly the remainder of the year, the Senate will be ground zero for a ferocious battle to replace Justice Antonin Scalia, who died 9 days ago. With the ideological tilt of the Supreme Court at stake, Republicans want the vacancy filled by the next president, not Barack Obama. They have the power to withhold confirmation of any Obama nominee and run out the clock on the administration. Senate Democrats are crying foul and have the power to block almost all legislation indefinitely in protest, effectively grinding Congress to a halt. Michael Bowman, The Capitol.
Taking a brief look at market activity on Wall Street, U.S. stock indexes were up at the close of trade today. Right now in Asia, stocks are mixed. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Burundi says UN Secretary General's visit has been constructive.
I can say that both meeting went very well and very positive. He's constructive. He's come here to listen to Burundian stakeholders, for him to have a better idea of what is the situation in the ground.
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. Central African Republic refugees say they will return to their country only when there is peace. We will talk about a new book on Boko Haram. Zimbabwe orders mining companies to cease operations immediately. And Uganda's government defends the treatment of opposition candidate Dr. Chisa Besigye.
Dr. Besigye has been announcing that he wants to defy all the laws and to march on in the city and so on, and because of violence. So the police is constructively engaging him.
Jim Muwezi is Uganda's information minister, and hundreds of refugees flee the United Nations protection site in South Sudan's Malaka Isle. Those stories, plus Mark Omar's sports and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Burundi says discussions with UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon during his visit to Bujumbura were positive and constructive. Mr. Ban arrived in the country on Monday to meet with President Pierre Nkurunziza and other actors as part of ongoing UN efforts at resolving Burundi's political crisis. Foreign Minister Alain Nyamitwe says his government told the Secretary General that Burundi is interested in a dialogue, but if such dialogue is to be truly inclusive, it must cater to as many Burundians as possible and not just a select few.
I can say that meeting went very well and very positive. He's constructive. He's come here to listen to Burundian stakeholders, for him to have a better idea of what is the situation on the ground and what could be the best ways possible in the search for a durable and sustainable understanding of our situation.
People are expecting that the Secretary General's visit will, what they say, bring new life to what they consider as stalled talks or any movement in the process, how to resolve the crisis. So did he offer any specific suggestions, or did you give the Secretary General any specific suggestions in terms of the way forward?
Well, I believe that the aim of his visit is that, as been portrayed in the media, I believe that he's a conservative trip. Among other things, they touch upon the issue of dialogue, and we are open to discuss with him about what we've done so far and what we put on the table for an all-inclusive, regionally worked dialogue has been accepted by the East African community. What we have said then and what we said today and what we tell again tomorrow is the balance one, is that if dialogue has to be inclusive, then we need to to cater for as many actors as possible.
Mr. Minister, a number of African leaders are supposed to be visiting your country this week. What will be the purpose of these African leaders coming? And is this a change in the position of your country in terms of the way forward?
No, again, this is a conservative trip of theirs, and we have welcomed them. We have accepted that visit because it's been decided by the 26th. session of the Assembly of Heads of State of the AU. We have not opposed it. We could not have opposed it anyway. But we have said they're most welcome and we are ready to talk to them.
On Monday, France introduced a resolution that calls for the deployment of UN police force in Burundi. And I'm not sure if your country is aware of that. This is a resolution introduced at the United Nations by France.
Well, you are the first to inform me. We will never consult on the issue. Again, we leave it to the wisdom of the Security Council. But if we were to be consulted, I do not think that we would okay such a move. I don't think that what we were not able to accept through the AU will be accepted now through the Security Council.
Has your government figured out who was behind the string of attacks that took place in your capital city just shortly before the Secretary General arrived there?
Well, it would be presumptuous of me to say that I know the very persons who were behind the attacks. But obviously, without any shadow of a doubt, whoever did it is against peace.
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. The Ugandan government has been defending the treatment of opposition presidential candidate Dr. Kizza Besigye of the Forum for Democratic Change, who was arrested again on Monday, his fourth over the course of 1 week. Dr. Besigye is challenging the results of last Thursday's presidential election. Ugandan Information Minister Jim Muwezi says the police is constructively engaging Dr. Besigye.
Dr. Besigye has been announcing that he wants to defy all the laws and to march on in the city and so on and cause violence. So the police is constructively engaging him as per the Public Order Management Act.
You said that he wants to march on the city to cause violence. That's a prejudgment. You don't know if there will be violence.
No, it has happened before when he marches into the streets. Crowds follow him, disrupt the trade and the people's business. That's what has happened before. It's not the first time. There has been a walk to work and so on. So we know what happens and the police knows.
There are several questions people have. If the elections is over and President Museveni has been re-elected, why did the government see the need to put someone who lost the election under house arrest?
No, this is not house arrest. No one has been put under house arrest. They have restricted his movement because of disruption of order. But otherwise, he's not under house arrest.
One would think that President Museveni's supporters will be rejoicing in the streets. Why worry about somebody who lost the election?
Of course, the president's supporters are jubilating and they will be jubilating. But Dr. Besigye is talking about or is refusing to accept the results of the Electoral Commission and is talking about opposing it using all methods, going on the streets and so on and so forth. So the police cannot let any person do that. Instead, they engage him. They engage him, and engaging him means, of course, going to police, making statements and things like that. But he's not under house arrest.
Dr. Besigye is refusing to accept the results because I think he said the process, the entire process was fraud, even that up to now they say that results from some polling stations have not been announced.
Well, I hope you are aware that in Tanzania the results for Zanzibar are not yet announced. Is there chaos? And besides, in our case, if one is not satisfied with the outcome of elections, we have laws that prescribe how you go about it through courts of law. Why doesn't he follow the law?
I guess the problem is that Dr. Besigye has gone to court many, many times after each election for the past three elections. But maybe he's saying that he does not trust the court system.
No, there is no limitation about going to court. You can go there 100 times. There is no any other shortcut to courts of law.
Even if the courts don't seem to favor you?
No, he has been talking about two of the judges or three of the judges favoring him and four not favoring him, he has been talking about. Definitely, our courts of law are impartial.
Retired Major General Jim Muwezi is Uganda's Minister of Information and National Guidance. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. Today is Tuesday, February 23rd, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Still to come, Mark Omar's posts in our Black History Month and African History Facts of today. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. Zimbabwe's Mines Minister, Walter Chidakwa, on Monday ordered all diamond mining companies to cease operations with immediate effect after the companies failed to renew their licenses. According to the state-controlled Hera newspaper, the minister told a press conference in Harare that the affected mines, mainly those operating in the Maringe diamond fields in Manicaland, have been notified about the decision. Reporter Jonga Kandimiri of VOA Zimbabwe Service spoke with Farah Munguwu, director of the Center for Natural Resource Governance, who says the government's move was a little too late.
It's too late. The damage has already been done. The diamonds have been filtered out of the country. This is what should have been done many years ago, and we have been calling for this for a long time. But I also think, apart from just stopping these mines from operating until they comply with the minister's directives, there is need for a commission of inquiry to investigate everything that happened in Marange. Government, by its own admission, acknowledges that Marange Diamonds has been looted. So there is need to investigate who did what.
Why are these mining companies not complying with the government demands of renewing their licenses and also forming that consolidated mining company?
I think these companies have enjoyed the benefits of lawlessness for a long time. So Minister Chidagwa is trying to bring some light on these operations. And naturally, these efforts will be resisted. If the companies comply, I think we have much to benefit than to lose as a country. I have confidence that the minister has got something that he is trying to drive at. He wants transparency. He wants to have a centralized management of the mining operations in Marange. I think he wants to reduce the military influence in Marange.
That was from Munguwu, Director of Center for Natural Resource Governance, Imuntare, speaking with reporter Jonga Kandimiri of VOA's Zimbabwe service. This month, a new book, Eat the Heart of the Infidel, is out on the shelves. It takes a detailed and complex look at the origins of Boko Haram in northern Nigeria. The author, Andrew Walker, who has years of experience living and writing about the region, tells Ricky Shryak about some misconceptions that are held about the Nigerian-born extremist group.
I've seen the rise of Boko Haram from 2009 onwards and seen the way that this country that I'd become involved with had just kind of crumbled and changed completely. And I wanted to, in some way, write about what happened, put it in a wider context. So what I wanted to write was not necessarily a blow-by-blow, bang-bang account of the violence that has come out the heart of the North, to kind of give a much more wider context to people who I think will probably be very, looking at it from outside, be very baffled at this whole situation.
What do you think is the most misunderstood thing about Boko Haram from the outside perspective of Nigeria?
The way that people come to it is they live their lives, and then occasionally they'll hear about this very violent incident and they'll kind of just look towards it and really not know how to deal with this shocking violence. And it just ends up that people just end up shaking their heads and shrugging their shoulders and just turning away. And I think one of the ways that this kind of was shown is that when people were saying, well, why don't we pay more attention to, why doesn't the media pay more attention to places like Nigeria? The media does pay attention to it. You know, it's regularly reported on by, but, you know, people don't read it as one kind of continuous thing. They just see it as being like spikes of interminable violence. And I really wanted to kind of show that there's a longer, much longer history to this story and that there are some pretty interesting little twists and turns in it.
One of the reviews of your book says that, you know, often Boko Haram appear as nothing more than a Nigerian offshoot of Al-Qaeda, but as you present it, the Boko Haram issue is over nothing less than Nigeria's identity. Do you think that's one of the things, is that you wanted to present it from what it has to do with Nigeria? Because often when it's discussed globally, they talk about ISIS or Al-Qaeda, when Boko Haram is very Nigerian.
Absolutely. Boko Haram is this thing that it's whatever the people who are commenting on it at that moment want it to be. For the longest time, people were desperately trying to show how this was connected to Al-Qaeda. And then as soon as ISIS came up, as soon as the Islamic State thrust itself into the world's view, everybody turned on a sixpence and started trying to connect Boko Haram with Islamic State. And that really kind of woke me up to the fact that a lot of these analysts who prepare reports for Washington, D.C., for London, look at it solely in a way that, how is it going to affect us? To do that is perfectly understandable, that's their job, but you miss a whole load of layers of what is actually going on the ground. You know, what's happening in Nigeria is all of these different regional power struggles, you miss that, and I think that's what's really happening.
That was Andrew Walker, journalist and author of Eat the Heart of the Infidel. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from London. Cameroon is home to more than 300,000 Central African Republic refugees who have been following with keen interest the presidential elections in their country. Will Faustin Touadera declare the winner? Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports for VOA on the expectation the refugees in Cameroon have for their new leader and how they expect to contribute to the peace process in their troubled country.
Belmont Vieux-Ose, former lecturer at the University of Bangui, now a refugee in Garoua-Boulaye, Eastern Cameroon, campaigned for Anicet Dulagele to become CAR president. The 52-year-old says although his candidate did not win, he is urging President-elect Faustin Archange Touadera to immediately work for peace.
Ce que le président peut faire maintenant là, moi je suggère de rassembler d'abord ses enfants.
He says the president-elect should first of all assemble all the republic's citizens because the country has so many problems. He says it is imperative for Touadera to make sure that schools reopen fully and civil servants start working. He says in order to achieve this, the new president should invite all religious, political, and community leaders to a negotiating table. He says since the elections were peaceful, his wish is that peace should return to the country. Jodia Kato, follower of former CAR President Bozizé, who was represented at the election by Anicet Dulagele, says former Prime Minister Touadera's victory indicates CAR is not ready for reconciliation and he is not sure anyone who supports his views will have peace should they return to CAR.
Nous qui avons combattu avec le président Bozizé, nous sommes recherchés partout.
He says they who fought wars in CAR alongside former President Bozizé have been declared wanted everywhere in the world, and as such, they are not sure of their security, adding that it's better for them to remain hiding in Cameroon. He says they cannot find peace if they go back to their country. Touadera Bienvenu says though his candidate, Faustin Archange Touadera, was declared successful, many of his supporters are still reluctant to return to CAR.
Vous savez qu'il faudrait d'abord qu'il y ait la paix dans le pays.
He says the first thing they need is peace, and if there is no peace in CAR, they will not return. He says even if there is peace, the decision to return should be individual because some of them who escaped had lost everything in the war and should not be forced to return. He says it will be unwise to ask a family head who has lost all of his belongings to return, because he will not be able to feed his children and send them to school. CAR has had a history of unrest since it gained independence from France in 1960.
That was reporter Moki Edwin Kinzeka in Yaoundé, Cameroon. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with handball. Hosts Egypt beat Turkey 37-28 to win the Under-17 Mediterranean Handball Championships in Alexandria over the weekend. Tunisia edged Saudi Arabia 17-15 to clinch the bronze medal. Turning to athletics, Zimbabwe's Rutendo Nyahora aims to make her marathon debut in the Austrian capital Vienna in April. She received a confidence boost after she placed second in the women's 10 kilometers at the Best Made Road Race in the South African capital Tshwane on Saturday.
The rest was okay. Like, my aim was to run under 35 minutes because now I'm busy preparing for the marathon. I haven't done my speed yet. So my aim was to run under 35 minutes, and I'm so happy because I managed to run 34:56.
You are thinking of the marathon. What are you aiming with in terms of marathon?
I'm aiming to qualify for the Olympics, Rio.
Yes. Well, what is your personal best?
I haven't run a marathon yet, so I'm training for my first marathon.
When and where do you plan to run your first marathon?
I'm going to run on the 10th of April, and I'm going to run Vienna Marathon. marathon.
Yes. That was Zimbabwe's Rutendo Nyahora, runner-up in women's 10 kilometers at the Best Med road race, speaking in Tshwane, South Africa. In Spain, Kenyan Cosmas Kiplimo Lagat ran a lifetime best of 2 hours, 8 minutes and 14 seconds to improve his course record at the Seville Marathon on Sunday. 2 years ago, he set the course record at 2 hours, 8 minutes and 33 seconds. Morocco's Hassan Aouchar was third, with South African Sibusiso Nzima fourth, in a lifetime best of 2 hours, 11 minutes and 43 seconds. In the women's race, Morocco's Kuta Boulaid was runner-up in 2 hours, 31 minutes and 25 seconds, while Kenyan Eunice Jepto placed fourth. Moving on to volleyball, Tunisia will stage the Africa 2016 Olympic Beach Volleyball Qualifiers, the Africa Volleyball Confederation disclosed in Cairo, Egypt. Angola, Burundi, Egypt, Gambia, Ghana, Mozambique, Morocco, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, and Tunisia have confirmed their entry into the three-day event in the coastal city of Hammam Gezaz, some 110 kilometers east of the Tunisian capital Tunis, starting on the 5th of May. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Mark. Have a good day.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
It's time now for Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 23rd. On this day, 1868, William Edward Bogart Du Bois was born in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. His mother raised him on her own, instilling in him the values of hard work and education. His family was poor but respected. William did well in high school and got a scholarship to Fisk University. He also attended Harvard University and became the first African-American to get a doctorate degree from Harvard. One of Du Bois' achievements was the formation of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. He also helped to educate America about what he called the problems of black people. But some criticized him for speaking only for the educated. Du Bois became discouraged about what he called the American situation and took up citizenship in Ghana in 1963. On August 27 that same year, Du Bois died in Ghana. On this day in 1895, former slave and diplomat William H. Hurd was named Minister Resident and Consul General to Liberia by President Grover Cleveland. Hurd was born into slavery in Elbert County, Georgia. While in Monrovia, Hurd also served as superintendent of the Liberia Annual Conference of the African Methodist Episcopal Church and built the first AME church in Monrovia, the Eliza Turner Memorial Chapel. On this day, 1869, the governor of Louisiana signed the Public Accommodations Law prohibiting discrimination on the grounds of race, gender, ancestry, and religion. Did you know that Madame C.J. Walker was the first female African-American millionaire? Walker became a highly successful businesswoman by selling her own brand of cosmetics. She used much of her money to help the needy. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 23rd. Congratulations to Obek Goltank of Jos South in Plateau State, Nigeria, and Paraswati Sisampa of Richards Bay, South Africa. You are the winners of our February 22nd question, who were the Tuskegee Airmen? The answer, the black servicemen of the U.S. Air Force. Now here is our question for today, February 23rd. What NBA team did Julius Winfield Irving or Dr. J play for? Once again, what NBA team did Julius Winfield Irving or Dr. J play for? Send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address.
Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Don't give it up, don't give it up.
Get up, stand up.
That's it for this Tuesday, February 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stradak, as well as post editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good Tuesday.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.